Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The signs are unmistakable. The science is undeniable.
Our special Earth Day program, I talk to UN Climate Chief Patricia Espinosa about new pledges and what it really takes to go green. Then,
you don't lead with the gloom and doom, and you don't beat people over the head. You draw them in, you say, you know, come on this journey, let's meet some friends.
From Avatar to the Titanic to whales, acclaimed director and environmentalist James Cameron joins me on a deep dive into the lives of these complex ocean creatures. Plus, the politics of climate change from Nixon to now.
Somehow, Republicans have migrated away from being concerned about the environment, and they need to get back to it.
Former Ohio Governor John Kasich tells Walter Isaacson how to get through to his own party on this global emergency. And finally, we meet Jerome Foster, 18 years old, and a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Board. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Look at this image. Children and adults wearing masks on the streets. It could be from today, but it isn't. It's from 1970. It's on the streets of New York, and it's on the very first Earth Day. Now, 51 years later, the calls to protect our planet from calamity are ever more urgent. This morning, President Joe Biden hosted a virtual summit to address the climate emergency with more than 40 world leaders. And Biden pledged to cut American greenhouse gas emissions by half by 2020.
The United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade.
We in India are doing our part.
Poor countries have historically contributed least to global emissions.
Mother Nature has nourished us, and we must treat nature as our root.
We will lift our ambition because we must.
Now, here in the UK, the government pledged a 78% cut in emissions by 2035. So what do all these pledges amount to? And the ever-important question, is it enough? Joining me now is the UN Climate Chief, Patricia Espinosa. Welcome to the program. We are reaching you at your headquarters in Germany. So let me ask you, did you hear anything today from all those world leaders that gives you any hope that there are real plans to reach that holy grail, which is temperature at 2 degrees or, at best case scenario, 1.5 degrees Celsius? Because one of your chief advisors says that we're on track to a 4 degrees Celsius situation.
Well, Christiane, let me say that we are certainly now in a different scenario from where we were just a few months ago. So, yes, I think the summit that was convened by President Biden demonstrates, on the one hand, that climate change is a top priority, especially now. This is particularly important, especially now, that leaders are taking decisions on the COVID recovery packages. That means it brings an opportunity for them to make the investments in the right way. And the fact that we have heard announcements to enhance the goals of the national climate plans by the US, by Canada, by Japan is certainly encouraging. I would say that we are not yet there where we need to be to actually go towards the 1.5 goal, because after Paris, where the 2-degree goal was approved with the expectation of going closer to 1.5 as possible. We saw the IPCC report, the report by the scientific committee, that says clearly that the 2-degree scenario is still a disastrous scenario. So we have to concentrate on the 1.5-degree goal. I am encouraged, but we are very far from there.
Well, very far from there is not encouraging because there's not a huge amount of time. If everybody's pledging this to all happen as they did today by 2030, the US pledging to cut theirs, you know, by half by 2030 and all these other commitments I just listed out, we have not seen, and there are calls for, a detailed roadmap, a detailed plan for what it means in what it'll cost, what kind of investments, what kind of actual strategic roadmap, as I say, they will be laying out. That has not happened yet. How worrying is that? And when do you expect that detailed roadmap to be delivered?
Well, that is certainly the big challenge now, that we see these pledges translated into very concrete plans. And this is why the way that the Paris Agreement requests countries to come forward with very specific plans by 2020, which, of course, is a deadline that was not met by all. We received 75 plans, but we have almost 200 parties to the Paris Agreement. That is why those plans are so important. You are absolutely right. We need to see those plans now. We have also heard from the US, from Japan, from Canada, that those plans are going to be coming forward very soon, and we are eager to see them. It is very important that those pledges are developed into very specific plans. In the case of the US, many measures have already been taken, and some others will be coming. But it is important that we have clarity on how this is going to be delivered.
So interesting, you do not mention, and twice you've mentioned a number of countries, you don't mention China, which is the biggest emitter. Obviously, President Xi was there and they have made their promises. But even, you know, in your own office, you know, they deliver a lot or they talk about it a lot, but they've still got long targets. Their targets are for, I don't know, 2060 or something, which is just not good enough. What can you do? And what do you think, for instance, the U.S. climate czar, John Kerry, former Secretary of State, who was just there, do you have any knowledge of what he might have got as commitments out of China?
Well, let me say that we have a very, very, very close engagement with China, and I'm very grateful that Presidential Envoy Kerry is also engaging with China because of their participation in global emissions, but also because of the many solutions that they have provided and the way that they have been transforming their economy and their society. China has not yet come up with a revised NDC. However, they have indicated that they will submit it very soon. We know that they are working in this very detailed plan and that we have heard from them is the reason why they have not yet submitted the NDC is because they want to have that specific plan with very clear milestones towards the peaking of emissions by 2030 or before, if possible, and the net zero by 2060 or before, if possible. Mm-hmm. So we are very hopeful also for China coming forward with a good plan.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, you said you feel, you know, things look more hopeful than perhaps they did a few months ago, even in the last several years. Is that because Donald Trump is no longer president of the United States, no longer denying climate, no longer rolling back environmental protections, no longer pulling the U.S. out of the climate accords? Do you feel that it's Biden's presidency that makes it more viable?
Well, let me say that, of course, yes, the U.S. rejoining the Paris Agreement is a very, very important signal. And not only rejoining the Paris Agreement, but also taking these decisions like the summit today, convening the leaders of the world to come together and talk about climate change and how we are going to move forward, is something that we didn't see happening in the last years since the Paris Agreement was adopted. We did see some important announcements last year at the General Assembly of the United Nations in September. However, we had not seen this focus at the highest level. And I really think that leadership is very central. We need that visionary leadership that will bring the world to emerge from tragedy that we have been going through in the last year towards a world of hope and a more resilient and more healthy future.
So you have called for, you know, all these governments and the EU and others to stick by their pledges to put green development and the climate at the very center of rebuilding after this pandemic and re-energizing the global economy. You know, President Biden says every time he thinks of climate emergency and dealing with the climate, he just sees jobs and he sees dollars. He says it's a no-brainer that if we do this, it will actually benefit our economies. But some countries don't see it like that. India and China, maybe, they think, well, you all had your time as industrial powers, and now you're telling us on the brink of our development that we can't do it. How do you have the kind of diplomacy with a country like India, for instance, that also is a big emitter, to rein it in?
Well, you know, it's very important that we acknowledge the fact that we should not see these transformations and these transitions in sectors, in isolated sectors. We should see the bigger picture. And when we consider that continuing to operate in business as usual mode will lead us to less food, to no water, to migration, to more vulnerability, then it becomes clear that doing these transformations is about investing in the future. It is not about, you know, giving in, or it is not about trying to renounce to some benefits, immediate benefits. Because it is very clear, the evidence of climate change and how much suffering and damage it is causing, especially to the poorest people, the most vulnerable, is there. So it is precisely talking about, you know, the bigger picture. What does really climate change mean? It is not in isolation the need to go to renewable sources. Why do we need to go to renewable sources? To provide our children with a green, healthy, and prosperous future.
Patricia Espinosa, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, the United Nations is also warning that our oceans are under threat like never before. The award-winning director James Cameron, an environmentalist who brought us the epic films Titanic and Avatar, has now turned his attention to the deep blue sea. His latest project, Secrets of the Whales, follows various species in 24 different locations around the globe, revealing that these complex ocean creatures might be a lot more like humans than we ever imagined. James Cameron told me all about it when he joined me from New Zealand. James Cameron, welcome back to our program. I want to know where you are, because you look like you're in, I don't know, underwater. I don't know where you are.
Well, you're visiting me on the planet Pandora right now. I'm in my cutting room working on the Avatar sequel films. And so thanks for dropping in to my habitat.
By the way, a great pleasure. And people, obviously, viewers are desperate for your Avatar film. But in the meantime, you know how to put, let's say in the English word, bums on seats. And I want to know what you were thinking when you took on this new project about whales for Nat Geographic and Disney+.
Well, I think a number of things. First of all, you know, Disney has acquired the National Geographic brand, and they're really leaning into it. They really love it. It's got, you know, sort of great alignment with their mission statements around, you know, helping people understand the planet and each other and so on. So that was a real, you know, plus going into it. Also, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be able to do the diving myself. So what could I offer? I figured I can work on the narrative with the people that are out in the ocean doing the hard yards over 3 years. Took them 3 years to shoot this, 24 locations around the world, lots and lots and lots of hours spent underwater and at the surface, as you can imagine, waiting for the whales to show up and, you know, do something interesting. And I think the challenge was, what are we showing people that they haven't seen before? Everybody's seen beautiful images of whales, slow motion, leaping out of the water and things like that. We all know it. It stirs our soul for some reason. We love these animals. What can we show people that they haven't seen before, or maybe teach them? I thought I knew a lot about whales. Turns out I'd only scratched the surface, so to speak.
You've done one of the episodes on ghost whales. I'd never even heard of it, but we're going to play this clip right now.
Sure.
There's only one truly white whale, like a ghost. And just as mysterious. Beluga whales smile, show emotion with facial expressions. They have one of the largest vocabularies in the ocean.
That must have been an amazing thing for a director like yourself to see and to try to, you know, put into a story which is being released on Earth Day. These animals that seem almost human.
Well, right. I mean, certainly our anthropocentric perspective is to ascribe human characteristics to the whales. Maybe we're just more like them than we thought previously. You know, what's the common through line? These are intelligent animals. They're emotive. You could see that with the belugas in particular. They have complex speech. The belugas especially have complex speech, but so do all the other species as well. And they have familial bonds that are generation to generation. They have matrilineal societies. They respect their mom and their grandmom and do what they're told, you know, and do what they're taught. They have culture, which is passed down from generation to generation. And we were actually able to film, you know, mothers and grandmothers teaching their sons and their daughters how to survive in very particular ways. You know, when a deer is born, it's just sort of born with the programming that it needs to survive. Whales aren't like that. They're operating on a higher level like we are, and their education is important. They grieve. They have emotions like ours. They'll mourn their dead. You know, we were able to image an orca mother pushing its dead calf with it around for a long period of time. It was several days. And it was in that grieving process of letting go that we understand as human beings.
That's just such a remarkable description. The families follow these ancient maps, really, road maps in the ocean for their long, long journeys. How were you able to follow that? Did you follow a whole journey, and what did you find?
Really good research is critical. So obviously there are cetacean experts that study the individual species, and we as the show went to them so that we could look at these aggregations and these special gatherings and you know, show up to tell the story. Part of it is knowing in advance what is likely to happen. But just because something's likely to happen doesn't mean it does happen. Because I've done a lot of dive work myself. You know, I know that there are times when the ocean gives you a gift, and there are times when the ocean sort of turns her cold shoulder to you. And obviously our teams were there for those moments where the ocean gave us a gift, gave the individual photographers like Brian Scarry a gift. Quite literally, when an orca female brought him a stingray and said, "You look a bit thin, you should eat," you know, and dropped it in front of him and then waited a little while. And then when he didn't eat it, she just took it. All right, I've got kids to feed.
That is amazing. So we're going to play another clip. It's the narwhal whale.
The narwhal's legendary horn is actually a long, sensitive tooth. Some females, and all the males, grow them. It's one of only two teeth they have. And exactly how it's used has been a mystery. Until now.
How extraordinary was that? Had you ever seen whales? What is the point of these long tusks?
Well, it's not terribly well understood. It probably plays a role in foraging on the sea bottom, but then most of the females don't have them, so they have to eat too. So we think it might be more of a male display thing. I mean, basically getting girls, you know, like a lion's mane or so many other things in nature. And that's the thing about all these animals. We don't know as much as we need to. And, you know, our human presence in the ocean is pushing them, many of these species, to the edge of extinction, or certainly they're under great duress. And we really need to understand them so that we can protect them.
I want to ask you the other important stuff about whales, which is their unbelievable contribution to carbon capture. I couldn't believe when I read that saving whales is much, much exponentially more powerful for, you know, a carbon-free atmosphere than even saving the Amazon rainforest. In other words, whales capture even more carbon. Did that come up? I mean, do you know about that? Did that come up in the film?
Sure. And so if you think about what a whale does, you know, it eats the animals that eat lower on the food chain. So a lot of carbon dioxide gets taken out of the atmosphere into phytoplankton. It's the base of the food web. The whales come along and just kind of snorkel it all up. And then when they die, their bodies sink into the deep where it's sequestered, where it's basically put deep in the ocean, won't come out for tens of thousands of years. So they perform a service for us every single day, keeping us from experiencing droughts and all the, you know, horrible weather, violent storms, wildland fires and things like that that are in our future getting worse and worse. So we need to protect them because they're actually doing something for us. That's called symbiosis. We're all in the same spaceship Earth here together, and they're part of the crew too.
It's really remarkable because I honestly don't think most people know that. Every time we think about carbon capture or the lungs of the earth, we think about rainforests and other such things. Whaling, yeah, basically, has been a way of life for so many countries. Apparently, the whale population has diminished by 90%.
It's not just the whaling, because the whaling is now located only in a few countries, and it's still making a dent in their populations, and we need to stop that, obviously. But it's really just civilization at large. It's what we, you know, we're using the oceans as a toilet for our runoff pollution from our farms and from our cities and so on. And that degrades the food chain. It becomes toxic. An orca mother's milk is often so toxic because of the bioconcentration of toxins in the water that its milk poisons its young and its calves die. Our ships hit them. Our fishing nets trap them so that they can't surface because they're air breathers, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's what that spout is when they come to the surface. That's them exhaling so they can breathe back in. Mm-hmm. And so they drown. A lot of them drown. Thousands of them drown every year in fishing nets.
And yet this series is not overtly about the climate and about climate change,
no,
is it? I mean, you don't really at all go into that.
No.
And I wonder why, what was the thinking going, given your background and your interest?
Yeah, well, I think you have to put the cart before the horse. You have to remind people what we love about these animals. It's not just that they speak to us kind of almost spiritually, meaning that they evoke that awe of nature. When we get to know them, we sort of get to know them in this series as people. We get to know them as characters. You could almost name them. They have individual personality traits, their emotionality and so on. We're not going to protect what we don't love and what we don't respect. So you don't lead with the gloom and doom, and you don't beat people over the head. You draw them in. You say, you know, come on this journey. Let's meet some friends. Let's meet some interesting people. Now when you've engendered that love and that respect, now the next question for people coming out the end of the series should be, what can I do about it? What can I do as an individual to make life better for these sojourners with me on this planet, these fellow beings that think like I do and feel like I do and have families like I do.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And of course, you reunite with Sigourney Weaver, and she's mm-hmm. also helping tell this story and introduce us to these, you know, these ocean family members. What was it like? She's doing the narration. What was it like reuniting with her on this?
Well, Sig and I have reunited many times over the years on different projects, and she's very active as a conservationist and as a spokesperson and activist for sustainability. So she was a natural choice, and it was really one phone call because she's fascinated by whales. She wanted to learn more. She knew she would. She tells a very funny story that she kept stopping because her mouth would sort of drop open while she was watching the footage, and she'd forget to narrate.
You know, she is a formidable woman in every single way.
Yes.
And I read, you know, you did Aliens, and she was obviously an alien. What was your first impression? Was she a bit intimidating?
I think I was more intimidated before the fact. You know, she's tall, she's, you know, so intelligent, she's got that ferocity on screen. And when you meet her, she's kind of not what you expect. She's kind of fun, she loves comedy, she's playful. So we really hit it off on that film. And she pushed back, she had a lot of challenges for me as a director, I had to defend my position. I think we got through that phase of learning to work together, and then it was just joyful, everything that I've worked with her on since then, you know, which is really now four Avatar films, because we did the first one and then we did three sequels, which are all in the can now.
So there are three new Avatars in the can, is that right? Is that what you're doing over there?
Yeah, this is my cutting room. You're dropping in on my editing room here, and I'll turn around and go back to Pandora when we're done talking about Earth and its amazing creatures.
And when will they be released?
Avatar 2 comes out in December of 22, and hopefully theaters will be back in full strength at that point, because obviously they're quite beleaguered right now. The whole theatrical film industry is on the ropes right now.
Do you think that, you know, your industry, in other words, going to the cinema, is going to happen again?
Yes, I think the demand will be there. I think people do want to go to the theaters. I'm less concerned about demand and people wanting to get out of the house and go experience that thing that we all know from the movies. I'm more concerned about the theater chain. So we'll see a contraction of the actual infrastructure, the number of movie screens that are available worldwide. And that's going to take years to rebuild if it ever does.
But it's a great experience, and I don't think you can ever get that experience of an Avatar or Titanic, you know, on anything other than the big screen. So we also hope it comes back. So I'm going to leave you to turn around and get back to your editing. Thank you, James Cameron.
Great conversation. Thanks, Christiane. Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You. And in tangentially related news, tomorrow, the American Museum of Natural History will be pressed into service as a COVID-19 mass vaccination site for New York City. The vaccine shots will be given under the museum's iconic blue whale, which is now sporting a massive Band-Aid for the occasion. So, sometimes we help save the whales, and sometimes the whales help save us. And next, even when the federal government in the United States has lagged behind, individual states have forged ahead with climate action. But now Biden's ambitious pledge has placed the crisis at the top of the Democrats' agenda. It is perhaps hard to imagine that climate was once a bipartisan issue that Republicans got behind as well. The former Ohio governor, John Kasich, has committed himself to raising climate change awareness. And here he is talking to Walter Isaacson about how the GOP lost its way in the thicket of climate denial. This conversation is part of the ongoing public media initiative, Peril and Promise, on the challenges and solutions of climate change.
Thank you, Christiane. And John Kasich, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, is there a climate plan that sensible Democrats and sensible Republicans could all agree on right now?
Well, I think there can be, Walter. I think so. And I think it's things like making sure we modernize the grid so that power can be moved in both directions, not just one. I think it's a lot of research and development into new technologies. particularly around batteries, although there's questions about the issue of lithium and batteries, from what I understand. But if you're going to have renewables, you've got to have storage. So I think there would be agreement that that we need storage. I think, you know, EVs, electric vehicles, are in the future. And I think there should be an agreement, or could be an agreement, about the need to have fast charging stations. I actually drive a Tesla, and my wife is like, sometimes she says, John, if we go out of town, you know, it's a hassle. And I think, you know, the hassle needs to be eliminated. I think most people would agree with that. As to how that gets accomplished, I'm not sure. I think there is agreement that carbon is bad, and that carbon sequestration, as we see ExxonMobil, I just read about it recently, they're interested in carbon and being able to capture carbon. I think there'd be interest in that, and perhaps a carbon tax, depending on what you do to it. You could rebate it. There's a lot of things you could think about. So I think there are areas where you could definitely have agreement. I think from what I understand, though, is that Republicans are very nervous it's going to disrupt all these jobs. And I think some of the claims about the fact that it's just miraculously all these jobs are going to appear is, you know, I think they're going to be skeptical about that. You'd have to explain it. But Walter, look, you've studied some of the greatest people throughout history. It's an ability of people to think about the we and not the I. It's the ability to break out of being trapped by your own self-interest and being able to think about the greater good for everyone. And there was a time when we did that in America, but that time is fleeting and it needs to be recaptured. And can it be? I absolutely believe it can be, but it's going to take time.
The simplest way to reduce carbon would be to put a price on carbon, either a tax on carbon or even a cap and trade, which is not quite as simple. You've mentioned that maybe you'd be open to a tax on carbon. Do you think that's something you could get other Republicans to support? And do you think that's really the best way to go?
Well, I think it's one of the things that you can do. And it's interesting, right, because it's Jim Baker and George Shultz that first started talking about the carbon tax. It was Reagan that was first expressed concern, according to George Shultz. I had a conversation with Secretary Shultz, and it was Reagan who was worried about the ozone. I think it was Nixon that might have created the EPA. You know, somehow Republicans have migrated away from being concerned about the environment, and you know, they need to get back to it, because for a couple of reasons. One is we're healthier. One of my great friends and great thinkers, Arnold Schwarzenegger, always says, instead of thinking about icebergs 30 years from now, why don't we think about the problem of asthma today, and health and clean water and clean air? Everybody's for that. And I think that when it comes to the issue of the carbon tax, it gets to be about where the proceeds of that tax go. I mean, some of it perhaps could be used to build infrastructure that we all know we need in this country, but that's a whole nother discussion about other ways of thinking about it. Or perhaps it's just to, as Jim Baker told me, just a rebate to the American people. But I think that the idea of a carbon tax is coming. I'm not so sure about cap and trade and all that, but the carbon tax is something that perhaps over time Republicans could support. Look, Walter, I mean, the problem we have is that the Republican Party is not the party that it used to be. I mean, that's like the understatement perhaps of the century. But at some point, good thinking people who understand science, and I mentioned it's about a cleaner environment, it's also about faith. I mean, the Lord gave us the planet. We're not to worship it, as some might want to do, but we are to be good stewards of it.
You've said the Republican Party isn't the Republican Party you knew, and that it's migrated away from caring about the environment. Why? Why did that happen?
You know, it's such a lot of things, Walter, that I can't put a firm finger on. But for some reason, this whole issue of science, I mean, got into question. I think some of the extreme voices were able to dominate and just move us away from some sort of givens or some principles that the Republican Party really held dear. Walter, I may not be the best one to answer these questions, because the Republican Party has always been my vehicle and never my master. And my view was, I'm an American before anything else, and a subset is the Republican Party. I never taken orders from them. So I may not be the best person to ask about what's happened because, you know, I was never a doctrinaire person. If the party doesn't want it, I'm not for it. But if you look at some of the great leaders in the party, Teddy Roosevelt, I'll tell you one that shook up the system was Jack Kemp. I mean, he thought differently. And there was more openness at some point to different opinions. And for some reason, the loud voices on the extreme of the party seemed to try to cancel out those people who were, frankly, more moderate, people who had good ideas. Now, every time I talk about this, I start thinking about this, and I'm not about to absolve the Democratic Party because there are members of that party who really engage in the cancel culture. If you don't think the way I do, I cancel you. And the party's got to be careful that they are not run by the extremes, the hard left, because I think most of the country operates in the middle. And if the loud voices on both sides, because I think you grow a country and policies, not that the extremes don't push the middle, but you grow things from the middle out, not from the extremes in. And I think in both parties, they've got to be very wary of this, of being able to let the extremes dominate.
What has caused this polarization when most of Americans probably do have a gravitation towards the middle, as you've said, and yet the parties have become more extreme?
Well, Walter, look, that's a much deeper question. We've gone from a culture of we, where we think about those things around us, which we had most of the 20th century, but starting in the 1970s or whatever, we've kind of moved to an I culture. What's in it for me, not for anybody else? And when you get yourself in an I culture, it disrupts everything. We can begin to get back to a we culture. And then in a we culture, the extremes no longer dominate because too much of that is about I and fear that I'm going to lose something, as opposed to the fact that we're all in a boat together and we have to row in the same direction. Today, one group rows going forward, one group rows going backwards, and a ship can't move anywhere. But it's not just true in politics. It's true across the American spectrum. Now, Walter, only a guy like you would ask me a question and actually let me finish those thoughts, because I think they're significant thoughts and they're impactful thoughts about how we can get our country back and begin to do the things that we care about. So on the environment, instead of a Republican being criticized because they work with Obama or they work with Biden or whatever, they say, wait a minute, there's a greater good here. I don't agree with them on everything, but there's things here that bring us together as a people. People will be healthier. The environment will be cleaner. Good things can happen. But right now, those considerations are secondary to what's in it for me.
More than half of the Republicans in Congress are now climate deniers, meaning they don't believe that human activity is causing climate change. And it's growing. You, on the other hand, actually moved in the other direction. You were skeptical for a while, to some extent, about human impact on climate, and you've looked at the science and moved in the other direction. How would you make an argument to that half of the Congress Republicans to get them to see it differently?
You know, Walter, more than being skeptical, I was just wasn't all that informed. I didn't know that much. But as governor, there were some things that were clear to me, that the more we could use natural gas, which is really the transitional fuel, we would have more jobs. If we fracked and we did it carefully and we began to capture methane more than even the federal government would require, if we were able to develop renewables and figure out some way ultimately to be able to store it, that just made all the sense in the world. And, you know, for me, I was overwhelmingly reelected in our state. And we reduced emissions like 30% over the last 10 years in the state. So these are just common sense things. We know that burning coal is not a good thing ultimately for the environment, that we need to move away from coal. We need to move into natural gas. I find it interesting that many on the left now have begun to embrace nuclear power. Remember, they used to have protests and wanted to shut all the plants down. Now they want to open them all up and build new ones. But, you know, over time, it just made sense to me to do these things. It was smart economically. It was good for the environment. I don't know how you can be a denier. I mean, I think part of the problem is they say we live in cycles, that cycles come and cycles go. But when you talk to them about the amount of carbon that we now see in the atmosphere and how it heats and creates the greenhouse gas effect and all that, Walter, if somebody just says, I'm not going to believe you, there's a lot of fish in the ocean. You got to move on to others. I think we find in this debate right now, and I know this myself, if I'm on with some environmentalists and I agree with them 80%, it's the 20% I become their enemy. You can't achieve anything that way. And by the way, you can shove all these policies through any way you want. They will not last. They will not be accepted. This has to be done even though it frustrates those who are the strong environmentalists, this cannot be done overnight.
Late last year, you set the tone for that type of bipartisan approach when you worked on World War Zero with Secretary John Kerry, who's now the climate envoy, and Governor Schwarzenegger. Are you going to continue to try to work with John Kerry and some people in the Biden administration to see where we can go?
Sure. But we've got to figure out a mechanism to bring more people around and to convince, we've got the usual suspects in the Republican Party who buy in. We've just got to figure out a way to kind of advance this among those and get some breakthroughs among people who you wouldn't normally expect to get breakthroughs from. And we've seen that happen in other areas. We've seen it in defense reform. We've seen it in healthcare reform. We've seen it dealing with the issue of poverty. We just have to bring people along, some of the unusual suspects who can say, this is really an issue and really a problem. But Walter, the other part of it is it's the grassroots, and this diverts us a little bit, but it makes my point. I was leaving as governor, I was trying to do some agreed to gun control measures. The problem we had is that nobody wanted to show up to support them. All the people in opposition showed up, but those who should have been for them never came. And there was no pressure. I think the same is true with the environment. I think more and more young people, by the way, are very, very clued into this. And the Republican Party better be very careful. They're going to lose all those young people if they don't bring them along to the issues they care about. And one of them is climate.
What is the role of business, both in moderating our politics and in finding common sense solutions on climate?
Well, as you know, businesses now are increasingly involved in ESG, environmental, social, and governance issues. And they are very, very interested. In my business, I work with them, and I've come to understand their deep commitment. And I've suggested to them that environmental, social, or governance change is not a matter of checking a box, but rather an issue of the heart. And I find more and more of them understand that. They get it. They want to move things. And frankly, I think they're just tired of the inability of the political system to solve problems. Now, when we talk about an I or we culture, we know there are a lot of businesses that have only cared about themselves. And so perhaps the issue of taking political stands or engaging in something like the environment can help them move them away from an I stance to more a we stance. Perhaps they can become a leader in the fact that in America, we're all in this together. So I'm very, very encouraged by the ideas that the business community has about not just environmental, but social issues as well, inclusivity, diversity. They are all starting to pay great attention to this. And I hope that the government can lead them into it rather than beating them into it, because when you beat somebody into something, then it becomes a check the box rather than a real evolutionary change.
You've proposed some common sense gun legislation. And with this spate of shootings we've had in the past few weeks, what type of gun legislation do you think should be passed? What are you pushing? And how would you get us there?
Well, the first thing that ought to be done is a red flag law. A red flag law says that if we know somebody at work or in our family who we think poses a danger to themselves or others, that you can go to a court and through a due process situation, you can take guns away from them. That makes all the sense in the world, because when people say it's a mental health issue, okay, I agree with that in many of these cases, But what are you doing about it? If you think it's a mental health issue, then you shouldn't let people who have these problems be able to have guns. Now, once they're stabilized, give them their guns back. But look, the biggest problem we have today in our country is the fact that there is not the training that we need of our police. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems that relates to this whole issue. We actually, I put together a group, Walter, on the issue of police and community right after we had some tragic incidents here in Ohio. And it has made a huge difference in the way that police and community work needs to be constantly upgraded. But we then moved towards gun measures. And this red flag law to me was something that was very simple, but yet the politicians figured out a way to not do it. Walter, until we have people demanding it, it's not going to happen, because the gun people who oppose this are very strong and they're very strident and they have to be respected. They can't be dismissed. But at the same time, if the people of this country say, look, we need to know who has those guns, and if somebody's unstable, they ought not to have a gun, then we can get into the issue of, you know, what type of gun should you have? That's another legitimate issue that needs to be discussed. But let's get some early victories, because we don't seem to get too many. And I know this sounds kind of boring to people, you know, but look, power goes from the bottom up. It goes from our hands up based upon a moral purpose that we have to say we will not quit until we get what we want. And a good example on environment about that, just taking that back for a second, is Greta Thunberg, who, you know, decided she was just going to hold a sign outside of a parliament and created a global movement. Everybody matters. You matter. What we do in the workplace, in our families, in our communities, driving change. And one of the areas that has to be changed are the gun laws in this country.
John Kasich, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And just to note, that conversation with the former governor was recorded before the fatal police shooting of the black teenager Makia Bryant on Tuesday in Columbus, Ohio. And finally, talking of Greta Thunberg, youth activists had been at the very forefront of the fight against gun violence and the climate crisis. And our next guest has had a truly remarkable journey, from protesting outside the White House to helping affect change in climate policy from inside. Jerome Foster held his signs aloft for 58 weeks as part of the global school strike for climate, which was sparked by Greta Thunberg. He did so mostly alone. And now, 18 years old, he is the youngest member of the Biden White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. And he's joining me now from New York. Jerome Foster, welcome to the program. That is a very long name for that body that you're sitting on right now. But just how does it feel personally? I mean, we see those pictures of you then and now. You must be so proud. Your parents must be so proud.
Yes, yes. Thank you for having me. And I think just being a part of this council is an incredible eye-opener for so many young people to know that our voice was heard. Specifically in the U.S., 17% of every vote was cast by young people. And now actually having a seat at the table to affect the policies that will help to save our climate is incredibly ambitious, incredibly responsibility-driven. But now it's time to take action. It's time to get policy to paper. And that's the work that I'm doing now.
So I'm going to get to that in a second, but I just want to know what it was like. I mean, you took a decision. I said you were in New York. You must have had to travel every week to Washington, D.C. to sit outside the White House with your sign. Were your parents supportive? Was your school supportive?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and I would go to the White House climate strikes. And it was definitely nerve-wracking going out there and striking every Friday, because there would be people from all different political perspectives walking by, frowning, some school children that I'll never forget that were just smiling and waving because they knew and were aware of the climate crisis at that young age. And every week it was just continually seeing how broad this climate crisis is affecting even our entire generation. And now it was, my parents weren't as in the first week or so, they were confused and they were like, why are you doing this? What is this movement all about? Why are you taking time out of school? And when I explained it to them and broke down the scale of the climate crisis and what action needs to be taken, they were 100% behind me and they were with me. They were helping to make sure that our message was heard. And a part of my climate strike was to pass the Climate Change Education Act, and it still hasn't been passed. But now through this position, we're going to continue to push that movement forward.
Okay, so was your school supportive? And what exactly would that do, the Climate Change Education Act?
Absolutely. So my school was not that supportive, unfortunately. A lot of my teachers would not allow me to make up old assignments. They were very combative and things like that. But as a school-wide, it was a mixed bag. There were teachers that were helping, and there were teachers that were definitely trying to be confrontational. But at the end of the day, it was just about what I was there for. If I'm studying for a future that doesn't exist, then why am I there? If I'm going there every single Friday and every single week and showing the scale of urgency around the climate crisis, that is a much louder message. And talking about the Climate Change Education Act, the reason why I went to strike is because I really understood that if a generation like mine was born into the climate crisis, and now after 70 years of inaction from politicians, we should be seeing some changes. And we should actually be learning about this in the classroom. So the Climate Change Education Act is basically adding environmental science as a core subject in American education, and also giving funding to youth research. And that is incredibly crucial because we are stakeholders, not just victims of this crisis. So we have to learn about it.
Well, exactly. And now to the White House. You're 18 years old. You're on the advisory council, as we said. What did they welcome you with? What was it like? You're the only one under 40. There must be some crusty old timers there. I mean, did they look at you weird? I mean, what did they think when you were part of the discussions there?
Yeah, I think when I first went to our meeting 2 weeks back, it was open arms, actually. It was all the older generations that were there, people that were 40, 50, and 60 years old, were excited to see young people, because even before this, I had done research at Harvard University and was able to talk with Representative Norton and at the United Nations. And every time a young person steps into a political office, politicians are excited because we are the future. We are the ones that are going to continue to push forward legislation. So even in the meeting that I was in at the White House, they were excited to see young people because we are going to continue to push for bold action to stymie this climate crisis. But yeah, it wasn't any people saying like, oh, what is this young person doing here? Because beyond the climate strikes, I've continued to show even in my academics and through my work that young people are at the forefront and they have to be included at the table.
And how did you get the call? I mean, how did you get the job?
Yeah, so it is a bit weird how it happens. It was nominated by some of the other members of the council and through the Biden administration himself around what people should be at this council. And it was originally due to the fact that in 10th grade, I had served on the D.C. State Board of Education to change Washington, D.C.'s graduation requirements for students graduating in 2030 to add climate science to their classroom. So through that work, they learned about, well, if a young person being the only person in the room at the D.C. State Board of Education, what if we include him in the White House to make sure that 40% of our executive funds go to frontline communities and young people? And that was kind of the process. It was just an email that I got in my inbox saying that I was invited to be a part of this council. And it was definitely shocking to see that in my inbox, but now it's a spark driven in me to be able to continue this work for so many people that should be at this council as well to represent my generation.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet Greta Thunberg?
Yes, me and Greta are very good friends. We talk very often, and she came to Washington, D.C. in 2019 at the White House to join me at the Ellipse. So We've talked several times, yes.
And just one question. Look, you heard all these amazing promises, but the years are 2030, 2035, 2040, 20, a long time down the line, essentially. You're young and you can see it happening now, and your generation of activists can see, you know, that they want stuff, you know, done now. Where is your head on what's going on, what President Biden is doing, and how it does seem to be quite far into the future?
Well, I would like to push back on that a bit. Based off of some of the science that came out throughout the past 2 years, we have about 6 to 7 years before we start reaching irreversible feedback loops. And I think with this work as a part of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, we are making sure that every legislation that is tailored to the environment make sure that 40% of those funds goes to communities at the front lines, like the Lower Ninth Ward, like Miami-Dade County, like parts of New York City, like Coney Island. So many of these communities have not been centered in the solutions. So we're looking back and now meeting the moment by looking back at Indigenous knowledge and people that are at the front lines and investing in their solutions. I think that when we talk about the far future, it's kind of disingenuous because it's already been 70 years. It's already been so many decades of inaction. So now when it comes to whether we're going to take action in the next decade or so, scientists are in agreement that we have 6 to 7 years before we start reaching catastrophic actions across our planet.
Jerome Foster, you can push back and you should push back anytime you like. It's an incredible achievement. And we're really happy to have had you on the program this evening on Earth Day. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.